a black and white strip cartoon.
Today in Studio 360, Gary Trudeau's Doonesbury, the original anti-establishment comic strip, has become an American institution. And its characters have changed with the times.
It's no easier to make them truly old than it is to look in the mirror and see yourself age. Every time I add white hair and I start removing hair, it's actually a big deal for me because it moves them closer to their own mortality.
And later in the show, the mysteries of the universe will be revealed. Sort of.
Versions of graviton particles making their way like a heartbeat through the universe being detected by laser beams that detect...
Comic musician Reggie Watts performs a lecture on astrophysics in front of a live audience.
Quite fascinating, even for the layman to understand.
That's all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
But you'll never know until you die. But that's okay, because it's really fun to live.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at scion.com. And by PBS. PBS reveals the amazing new stuff that could remake our future, like artificial muscles, cancer-fighting nanobots, and car parts made from mushrooms. What's in the lab today could be in our lives tomorrow. Nova's Making Stuff, starting Wednesday at 9, 8 Central on PBS.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Ever since the shooting last Saturday in Arizona, I've been following the reaction online. One thread of commentary that's really struck me is that of the novelist Walter Kern on Twitter. One of Walter's recent novels was called The Unbinding, in which he conceived of a character not unlike Jared Lautner.
Well, it was a sense of recognition. I mean, when Lautner revealed himself and he reminded me of this character that I'd created, in some ways, the egomaniacal part of me thought, I saw this coming, but I also had a fearful sense that the forces that created this Lautner, which are somewhat new, you know, the internet, may be spawning more of him. And then I had a little shock of fear. And I think that's what led me to Twitter so much, because I thought, you know, I hope the zombie army isn't coming out of the woodwork here. I mean, that's my terrible fear, is that while we're trying to talk about this, other Jared Lautners are logging on to the MySpace account and leaving their last testament. I hope that we learn to recognize this type is among us before more damage is done.
One of your tweets that struck me was, has anyone noticed that 3/4 of young adult culture involves vampires, zombies, serial killers, and gang wars? You're saying if we're trying to point fingers, we should point it at all of us who have created and occupy this virtual world.
Well, it seems like this guy, I mean, I've seen descriptions of him as someone who slept all the time because he preferred the dream world to the real one. Well, we're allowing this dream world created by the internet and the ability to wear an iPod 24/7 and so on to sort of take over our lives if we wish. And it's not having good effects on people who are tenuously attached to reality in the first place. Isn't it incumbent on us to look at its actual causes and the actual climate in which it grows up, not just use it as fodder for our old, boring political arguments?
Yeah. And it seems to me, I mean, among other things, people are permitted by this technology and greater production values than ever to sort of exist as fictional characters of their own devising.
Exactly. And if we look at this story as a story and not as a basis for issue-oriented argument, we see all sorts of characters who are stranger than fiction, as it were, who defy stereotypes, defy partisan description. We see a gay man who rushes in like a hero in a Western. We see a crusty sheriff who looks from a distance like he's going to speak like John Wayne and then sounds more like Robert Kennedy or something. We see a young Jewish congresswoman who was actually pro-gun and very middle of the road, who insisted on meeting the public in a very polarized district and showed more courage than, dare I say it, Sarah Palin shooting a moose in Alaska. So I would only ask as a novelist that we stay with the reality here rather than, you know, ride the hobby horses we came in on until they're dead.
Yes, and not try to take all these beautifully, strangely shaped pegs and pound them into the round hole we have chosen in advance.
You know, I'm a writer, and there's one vision of America that I think we could use more of. You know, there was a time in the 19th century when Walt Whitman, you know, through his poetry, painted a portrait of America as this wonderfully diverse, truly diverse, not in some sort of check-the-box sort of way, society, made up of people who defied description because freedom had allowed them to grow into shapes that the old world might not have allowed them to grow into. And if we look at this through a Whitmanian lens, I think what will be revealed is everything good, interesting, fascinating, and troubling about our democracy. If we can take it all and look at it globally, handle it, and appreciate it, we may come out of this having actually learned something rather than just found a new basis for our old conflicts.
Walter Kern, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Walter Kern is the author of the novels The Unbinding, Up in the Air, and others, and you can follow him on Twitter at Walter Kern. For the last 40 years, Gary Trudeau has been looking at American life and politics through his comic strip, his great comic strip, Doonesbury. For the last few of those years, he's placed some of his characters at the front lines of America's wars. B.D., for instance. B.D. was a former football star and coach who was serving as a soldier in Iraq when his platoon was hit by an IED. He lost a leg. And this is the big deal for the purposes of the comic strip. He had to take off his helmet. BD had been wearing helmets for more than 30 years.
So how you feel today, BD?
Like crap, thanks. But I'm also here, so I guess I'm good, big picture-wise. You can't take your eyes off it, can you, Ray?
What's that, man?
My hair.
Well, it's a little shocking.
Commemorating Doonesbury's 40th anniversary, there is now a gorgeous and massive new anthology celebrating those first four decades. And Gary Trudeau, my friend, it is a pleasure finally to welcome you to Studio 360.
Oh, thank you so much, Kurt.
So the strip was born when you were a kid in college in the middle, at the height of the Vietnam War. How did the Iraq and Afghanistan wars change the strip for you? And did you know that that would happen as soon as they happened?
Well, the strip began as a kind of oppositional response to a war. But I was, as you say, a kid and had no experience with war and wrote from a somewhat countercultural, can't we all get along perspective, and took BD over to Vietnam to get out of a term paper. And he's taken prisoner by a Viet Cong terrorist named Fred. They get lost in the jungle together and hilarity ensues. That was obviously something of a hippie fantasia that bore no resemblance whatsoever to warfare as it was being experienced by our troops at the time. And yet none of them seemed to have begrudged me that. When I talk to Vietnam vets now, their position was, no, there was no real verisimilitude in what you were writing, but you were writing about us and you were thinking about us. And that was a lot more than most people seem to be doing.
When did that start? I mean, in the 70s, would Vietnam veterans come up to you and say that kind of thing? Or was it you against them?
It's mostly in recent years because I've just gone to more veteran events as a result of writing about the wounded warriors of this war. But I've heard from them through the years. There was never any malice from the troops. In fact, the strip was picked up early in Stars and Stripes, I think 1972 maybe. And the war was still in progress, or 71, it'd have to be even earlier. And
that's amazing in and of itself.
And there were attempts to boot it out, but generally there was pretty strong support, particularly on the troop level.
And then after 9/11, we invade Afghanistan, we invade Iraq. At what point did you say, okay, I've got to send BD over there?
Well, he had actually served in the first Gulf War, and so I had him go over as a public affairs officer. BD is wounded in an action outside of the Battle of Fallujah. You may recall the first Battle of Fallujah was particularly bloody. The Marines really got chewed up bad. And about 3 weeks into it, I decided that, again, I would respond to it in the strip by tracking the kinds of sacrifices a wounded warrior would be making. So BD is attacked by a rocket and loses his leg. About a day after it's obvious that he suffered this grievous wound, I received word from the Department of Defense. And they said the Pentagon is notices that you have been doing this, and they think it might be better if you got it right. And so feel free to come down. We'd like to give you a tour of Walter Reed. Originally, they sent me in under a USO protocol because they weren't quite sure what to do with me. I wasn't quite a journalist, and I wasn't quite an entertainer. And the advantage of that protocol is that you're not wandering into anyone's room where you're not wanted. Because a wounded soldier might not want to see you for any number of reasons. They wanted to make sure that I was talking to people who wanted to talk to me. So I went in and I started interviewing amputees on Ward 57. And after a while, everyone kind of got used to my presence, and I began to show up pretty much when I needed to hear new stories as I made my way downstream in telling the story of a wounded warrior. So I got into occupational therapy and physical therapy and separating out in the Veterans Administration and vet centers.
Would guys tell you things, people tell you things, soldiers tell you things that you would immediately say, whoa, that's a good line?
Well, not so much a good line. Yes, they use a kind of black humor amongst themselves. It's the one thing that kind of keeps them from going mad is that they make pretty good fun of their own condition. And there were wonderful jokes that I heard, but I don't really tell jokes in the strip. It was more just kind of getting the tone of the conversation, trying to get the tone right. And as you pointed out earlier, the details of what a recovery process looks like. I didn't want to contribute to the pain they were already experiencing by getting those things wrong.
By going so deeply into this and so realistically into this for a thing in the funny papers and into these wars, is there anything to the fact that you're somehow atoning for your anti-warism of 35 years ago?
Well, only if you think I'm atoning for my anti-warism today, because I have been anything but a supporter of our current wars. Like any citizen, I feel free to pick and choose those that I think are wise and just and those that I don't and those in between. However, I find that when I go in and talk to soldiers or when I go out on bases, no one's talking politics. That's the last thing on their minds. They're talking about their unit, their teammates, the mission that they're tasked with. But rarely do they step back and try to argue the larger position.
BD has once again become a sort of bigger star than ever of the strip. Some of the other characters that used to dominate in the 70s and 80s have sort of faded away. Do you just lose interest in some of them?
Well, certainly BD is one of the foundational characters, and I have kept the spotlight on him. But most of the characters that readers seem to be most interested in, that I'm most interested in writing, are the younger characters. Mike's daughter Alex.
Who's now suddenly the star of the show.
She suddenly is now front and center. And I think that's because what the strip is, his strength has always been, it's been a portrait of a generation becoming itself. And now we're in the beginning of a third generation of characters. And I think that's my strong point. That's the thing that most interests me, certainly. It's the thing I'm most curious about. What does a generation look like as it comes of age?
Now that Alex Doonesbury, Mike Doonesbury's daughter, is in graduate school and becoming a sort of central protagonist of the strip, first of all, you have children more or less her age. Do you use them and pluck things from their manner of speech and behavior and attitudes?
I assume so, but it's certainly on.
They haven't charged you with it yet?
Yeah, no one has charged me with it. There are bits and pieces of my daughter's speech patterns that I've picked up through the years that have made their way into Alex's character, but for the most part, it's not a conscious process. I just try to be a good listener. I mean, I like my children. I like their friends. I spend time with them. I hang out with them enough so that I have a bit of a feel for
it. So that's why 10 or, well, more like 15 years ago, you suddenly had characters saying, yo, all the time.
Yeah. Right. Whatever the what I was hearing at home, I'm sure was and on television and movies, and you know, the culture just kind of stirs the pot for you, and you just have to pay attention.
Alex's boyfriend Toggle has become a major character, and he in his sort of background and life is very unlike most of the other characters you've ever created. He had a brain injury in Iraq. There goes one of those things again. But he lives in this trailer park.
Alex, after three.
I'm almost done.
Grad school hard?
It's this one professor. She thinks the students are hired help. She gets away with it because she's one of the big stars in her field.
What field?
Bioinformatics and proteomics. It has to do with protein analysis. It's pretty esoteric stuff. I don't think they offer it at your community college. How's school going, by the way?
Good. Learning to spell.
I'm sorry, Leo. That was old Alex. New Alex doesn't patronize.
He's from a blue-collar background and was one of those kids who went into the military because he saw it as a real opportunity. He was quite ambitious and saw that it might propel him into college.
And did you at some point have the thought of, oh, I don't want another Ivy League proto-yuppie. I want this kid?
No. Again, I started with a very narrow subject. I started with the dangers, if you could believe this, the dangers that are created within armored vehicles when the operators are listening to their MP3 players. And that was the simple idea that began Toggle, because Toggle was known in his unit as the guy who would fill up your MP3 player with music and customize it to your taste. He's explaining all this to his sergeant while wearing earbuds and driving the vehicle and doesn't hear the warning about the suspicious-looking vehicle on the side, and it blows up and he has this injury. So it started with a very small idea that was richly informed by the contributors to The Sandbox, which is a mill blog I run on Doonesbury.com. And they had all explained to me how
mill
this—
Mill blog meaning soldiers contribute to it.
Yes, mostly downrange, mostly in the field, who are writing blogs for us. And I sent out a notice to them, said, I understand this is potentially a real problem. And all the enlisted guys wrote back and said, yeah, here's how you do it. And they told me how they hot-wired the camo systems and, you know, incredibly dangerous. And the officers would write back and say, no, this is a really stupid idea. We would warn you against even, you know, putting this in the strip. But I knew this was going on, so I flagged it and then created this character in which to tell this story. And again, didn't really know what kind of injury he would receive. I brought him home with a brain injury with serious deficiencies in his speech. And I thought, well, that's interesting. How am I going to get comedy out of that? And I wrote the doctor who was advising me, and I said, I've got him with aphasia. I think there's a kind of aphasia called Broca's aphasia in which he is thinking coherently, but he is having real problems forming words and sentences. If I got that
right. Comedy gold.
If I got that right. Well, it is. Because yeah. he said, yes, that's exactly right. So what I had was in any given conversation in the early weeks of his recovery, you had three voices. You had what he was thinking, what he meant to say, and how it was being received. So there's all kinds of opportunities for misunderstanding that permit him to keep his dignity, which was critical.
There's another. Is that a weapon?
No.
Oh, no. Hurt you?
Not yet. Can you let go of my head?
Oh. It's like a loop. See insurgents on parapet and freeze. Same panic every night. I should go to vet center like BD said.
Maybe you could fire some warning shots at him.
I think I should talk to professional.
Just try it. They might scatter.
Didn't... used to have nightmares. I should probably go to vet center, get help, but... don't like talking to stranger about personal stuff.
Personal stuff? Like a serious new girlfriend?
What
does mean exactly?
means I have aphasia, Alex.
Oh, yeah, okay, sorry.
One of the trademarks of the strip from very early on is the wordless third panel, the sort of reaction shot with the characters often in silhouette. How did that start, and did you immediately realize, okay, I'm gonna do this a lot?
You know, I don't remember now, but I have a feeling I was probably picking that up from Peanuts. Schultz had a lot of those beats, those silent moments, and I don't know if it was a direct steal, but it was probably one of those early influences. Yeah, the other thing that I think probably came from Peanuts was the coda. There's a second beat in the last panel that somehow smooths it out, makes it look less punchline-driven and more like part of a conversation.
Yeah, and the eyes of your characters, was that just the way you drew at 19, or were you trying to make them look stone, sleepy, world-weary? Pick your adjective.
Well, that certainly was, the effect, whether it was intended or not, I can't say. When you're putting together a style when you're 18 or 19, you're just borrowing from left and right, and you're trying to put them together in some combination that seems fresh and original. I suspect I was studying the various ways in which Jules Pfeiffer was drawing eyes. I don't know if he had that hooded eye in particular, but I know from a very early age I was doing paintings with characters with hooded eyes. I guess it just turned out to be just right for an irony-soaked age.
Yes, indeed. You've been doing this 40-odd years. You're 62. As Mike Doonesbury and your generation moves closer and closer to the end. Is that suggesting to you new ways of being funny and being amusing in Doonesbury?
The aging process?
Yeah. And all of the original people getting old and, you know, retiring or whatever it is they'll do.
It's no easier to make them truly old than it is to look in the mirror and see yourself aging. I mean, it is tough. Every time I add white hair and I start removing hair, it's actually a big deal for me because it obviously moves them closer to the to their own mortality.
Gary Trudeau, thank you very much.
My great pleasure.
The book 40, A Doonesbury Retrospective, is out now. In our radio version of Doonesbury, Kat Pilardi played the role of Alex, Max Jenkins was Leo, Rob Pruitt was BD, and Lawrence Ballard was Ray. You can see some of the strips you heard at studio360.org. And while you're there, if there's a strip, a Doonesbury strip that has been especially moving or important to you, drop us a line and let us know about it. Coming up...
I mean, I'm just like more interested in Brian or whatever because he's just like more interesting than knowing the nature of the universe.
The singular and hilarious Reggie Watts writes a love song to the universe.
The universe is like a candle in the wind.
We get down and dirty with outer space. That's ahead in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Higher dimensionality.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion offers options that let everyone express his or her creativity to customize their car to fit their lives. Creativity begins at Scion.com. And by PBS. PBS reveals the amazing new stuff that could remake our future, like artificial muscles, cancer-fighting nanobots, and car parts made from mushrooms. What's in the lab today could be in our lives tomorrow. Nova's Making Stuff, starting Wednesday at 9, 8 Central on PBS.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. If you've been hearing our show lately, you know we like to do stories about the ways that science and creativity collide. A couple of weeks ago, we attempted one of our most ambitious science stories yet. Studio 360 takes on theoretical physics. That's especially tricky because those theories can get pretty abstract. String theory, membrane theory, the nature of time. So we called in a couple of our favorite guests. The astrophysicist Jan 11 and the comedian-slash-musician-slash-adorable genius Reggie Watts. Here he is in WNYC's Jerome L. Green Performance Space in front of our live audience, opening the show.
Universe is like a candle in the wind.
like a candle exposed to the forces of chaos and therefore undeterminable in its final outcomes. Therefore, what is the explanation behind this inconsistency? Higher dimensionality, I think, is the way of the future. Just give yourself a little bit of room. Understand the layers like an onion, making you cry. Yes. Rub some water and maybe you'll hear for yeah. Holographic, but you'll never know until you die. But that's okay, because it's really fun to live in the meantime, right here in physics world. You like it? Yeah, I love it. I love it. I love it. But it's something that's really fun for you and I to imagine, and science fiction to use in a pseudo-scientific fashion for you to believe that a world is more credible in an immersive environment as they're creating science fiction plots that don't really make sense, but the visual aspect is what we went there for the first place to see it. Just like Tron. Tron's not going to be a very good movie, but it's going to look really good in 3D because the characters are really cheesy and the actors are really corny, but that's okay. They ruined a really good chance, but it's the universe. Of 78 dimensions, but we won't know that for 32 years.
Reggie Watts. Sir. So, Reggie, We didn't just shoehorn you into this show about theoretical physics. You actually are a big theoretical physics buff.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I enjoy kind of generally understanding it. Obviously, I'm horrible at mathematics, but I love what ends up coming from the possibility of describing something in a different way, and then like the implications
for how people think, man.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
Can you read whole articles about cosmology and astrophysics and Scientific American and understand them to the end, or do you get to a point, as I do with each one, where I just feel like I'm stoned and can't understand anything more?
I mean, I love it. I usually can hang with it because I haven't read many books in my life, but the books I have read, especially in the 90s, were all physics books, like the philosophy of physics had, like the Tao of Physics or the Turning Point or Star Wave by Fred Allen Wolf, like these types of books. They were kind of technical, but I loved trying to understand what they were talking about.
Yes.
Like it's a beautiful mental exercise.
Well, as it happens, we have somebody who knows all about astrophysics.
There's no way.
Yes, right here. An accredited physicist. Jan Levin is a professor of physics and astronomy at Barnard College at Columbia University. She's also an award-winning novelist. Please welcome Jana Levin. Thank you, Jana.
Thank you. Hi.
So, we have a lot of questions for you.
Okay.
First of all, we all live our lives every day, we think, in four dimensions. The three obvious ones plus time. But I read these physics books and physics articles, and I read that there are many more than four dimensions. How many dimensions are there?
Well, we don't know that there are more, but it's a realistic possibility that the universe has more than four space-time dimensions. And it's kind of most popular to discuss 10 dimensions total, so 9 space and 1 time, or possibly 10
most
space.
Most popular?
It's most popular. I mean, it's an issue of what works best theoretically. The math leads one to say that it's possible that there are more dimensions, but this was understood as soon as Einstein said that space-time was something that could evolve, that was mutable, that wasn't fixed.
100 years ago.
Yeah, as soon as he raised that possibility, people were talking about extra dimensions, and it far predated string theory and things like that.
And are there any reasonable speculative notions of what those dimensions are, or is it just about the number? Yeah, there are 10. Or, oh, there are 26.
Well,
what's going on?
We do have one really important observational fact, and that is that it looks four-dimensional, right? You know, all of us confirm this observation every day that the universe looks like it has three spatial dimensions in one time, and so there has to be a way to hide them. So we go to great lengths, if there are extra dimensions, to figure out how they're hidden and why they're hidden.
So why can't we see them is the question.
Yeah, and one of the first idea about that was that they were small and we didn't see them because our hands and atoms and light and everything was too big to fit inside that extra dimension.
Do we no longer think that?
Well, there are other possibilities now that are more modern because they're inspired by things like string theory and M theory, which you rapped about, which suggests
Reggie
that...
Reggie is a big M theory guy.
Yeah,
he is.
And I think it was his idea, actually. So M theory suggests that there are other structures and strings, maybe entire membranes, maybe four-dimensional membranes, things that are three dimensions that evolve in time, and that we're just glued to one of these. So the universe could be very big in the extra dimensions.
But we're just the bugs
we're
crawling on one.
We're stuck on it, yeah, and we can no longer notice those extra dimensions because we just can't pull our hands off of the membrane that we're glued to.
It seems to me, talking about contemporary physics, theoretical physics, and using all these metaphors of strings and membranes, it's all metaphorical. It's all like a 21st century version of poetry. Is that part of the attraction for you guys?
I guess it's, for me, it's just being able to explain something that is really fantastic through science. It like gives it kind of a credibility, you know, in a way, because I believe in magic and like the feeling of spirituality, but I also believe that it can be described through physics or science. And I think that the beautiful thing about science is that, you know, it never claims to know absolutely. And if someone proves something differently, then everyone's like, okay, all right. Yeah. All right, that's fine. Okay, yeah. That's cool. All right, I'm a professional. Okay, well, let's start going your way. Let's see what happens. You know, like, instead of like, you know, oftentimes in philosophical beliefs or religious beliefs, like we're so absolute about things. And to me, the human mind is about elasticity and naturally, innately being explorers. And so when
and
we go
reacting
around circles,
to actual new facts rather than simply digging in your heels when you believe something is true.
Yes.
What does physics, Jenna, have to say about time? How is the state-of-the-art physics version of time different than our experience of seconds and minutes and hours passing?
Mm-hmm. Well, time has a kind of strange role in modern physics scientifically. We don't understand why time has one direction and one direction only.
That time's arrow thing?
Yeah, I can never go backwards, but I can, in space, I can go in both directions, always. Maybe time always exists forward and backward. It's just our path through it that's very specific. And it's like living on a mountain where all directions of time are there, but we're just confined to a certain path, and so it's our perception that links forward in this direction.
Reggie, when you're performing, is your sensation of time consistently different from how it is when you're at home in the Barca Lounger reading?
It's weird that you know that I have a Barca
Lounger. I was going to say that.
that is strange, but weirdly not surprising. I mean, you know, in performance, it's interesting because time kind of, you know, the idea of bullet time that was introduced, you know, by The Matrix or whatever, or the sensation that athletes feel in moments where they're about to do something extraordinary, like they just, everything slows down, or at least the recollection of it slows down. But in performance, live, as it's happening, I definitely have an expanded sense of time. Like, I feel like I have 80 more options within every given moment.
Really? So you are Neo, and you're just moving.
It's kind of like that, because if I'm performing and I get into a zone where a time kind of like expands, and then it disappears and I'm not aware of it anymore, suddenly I'm singing notes, and I'm honestly I'm not thinking of those notes I'm singing. It's like on autopilot. That happens, and it's weird. I'm like observing myself singing.
Huh. Call in the neuroscientist to have a look in there.
Yeah.
I will.
Calling all neuroscientists.
Now, Sir Reggie, I want you to show us what you think the universe and its contents sound like.
Yeah.
Reggie Watts.
Forty-two years ago, there was and you ever thought that I could? Oh, you think you do, eh? Did you ever think about the time when you were the last one on my list? Didn't you? People are just, you go, because you just can't do the things to do. Would you know when you're taking the cookie and you put in the cookie where the cookie's supposed to be in your mind? Come here and you say things and end this. Rudy was never the.
Are you? Yeah. Absolutely. No, I totally will. Now, the universe, I mean, whatever. I mean, I'm just like more interested in Brian or whatever because he's just like more interesting than knowing the nature of the universe. Yeah, well, when you get someone that makes you feel the way he makes me feel. Okay. Yeah, I definitely will. Yeah. Now, just, okay, here we go. Because the science sounds like a science and science and science and stuff. Science, science, lots of science and stuff. You want some science? Yes, some science. 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 Some science.
I want the science. Yeah. Come on, baby. Let me show you how it is.
The great Reggie Watts. We also heard from Jan 11 of Columbia University. You can hear Reggie's full performance and watch a video of our entire show at studio360.org. In fact, all of the stories and slideshows and other content from our series about science and creativity are there for your listening and learning pleasure for free. Coming up,
I've changed one word.
Is Huckleberry Finn still Huckleberry Finn without the N-word? Our listeners had a thing or two to say about that. We'll hear from you next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at Scion.com.
This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Last week, I spoke with Alan Gribben, the professor and Twain scholar who has removed all the N-words from his new edition of Huckleberry Finn.
Just get rid of the word, and then you can start talking about the story and the beauties and the sharp social critique in these words. I haven't changed any satiric descriptions and his cutting little insights. I've changed one word.
I wasn't crazy about the professor's new edition, and nor were most of you. We got tons of comments on our website, most of them slamming the change. Raji Riverstone wrote, "White liberals need to grow a pair and stop allowing revisionist history to wipe away the legacies of enslaved peoples on this continent. If we refuse to look at a word in historical context in American literature, we are cowards." When I was talking to Professor Gribben, I'd quoted Twain, who said about objections to Huck Finn a century ago that it was like, quote, telling a man he can't have steak just because a baby can't chew it. And to that, a listener named Stern responded, "The cutting up the steak comparison doesn't work because this level of rewriting is reducing this novel to McDonald's meat." But SQ from Brooklyn disagreed. Congrats to Mr. Gribben. And shame on Kurt for calling people, probably mostly black folks, who find the N-word offensive, babies. Note to SQ, that was Mark Twain who called such people babies, not me. Are we through talking about this? If not, let us know your opinions at studio360.org.
In starlight you came from the other side to offer me mercy, 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 mercy.
This is a track from the album The Crying Light by Anthony and the Johnsons. On the cover of the album, there's a stark black and white image of a very old person. It looks almost like a corpse come to life. Look closer, you can see it's an elderly Japanese man dressed in women's clothing. The man is Kazuo Ono, who was a master of the Japanese dance form called Buto. He died last year at 103. Buto was developed just after World War II. It's minimalist and abstract and sometimes grotesque. To a Westerner seeing it for the first time, Buto can look scary and off-putting. But when he came across it, the singer Anthony Hegarty fell in love with the work of Kazuo Ono.
Well, when I was 16, I went to study the French language in Angers in France. And on the street, you know, men were putting up the posters for an event, a local event. And they had a poster of a very old Asian dancer dressed in a kind of frightening Victorian clothes and a white face. And the picture just really appealed to me. You know, it was kind of expressionistic, and I asked them if they would give me one, and they did, and I put it over my bed, and it has been there from that day to this, so it's been over my bed for 25 years. And I didn't think any more about it until I moved to New York 4 years later, and I went to see a film by Peter Semple called Just Visiting This Planet, and at one point, an old man started to dance, and he was doing this performance with these rocks that were crumbling on the side of a hill, and I just started crying, and I was like, I don't know why I'm crying. And I went home, and I saw the same picture of the man over my bed, and I thought, oh my God, it's the same guy. And that was how I discovered Kazuo Ono.
And now we're disentwined. It's hard to understand.
And then I became obsessed with him. I started studying with a Buto dancer, And I just slowly learned more and more about him. I saw him perform 3 times during the 90s. And I realized fairly early on that the kind of butoh I was interested in was Kazuo Ono. It was him in particular that I fell in love with.
Ghost.
The word butoh translated means something ghost, like the dance of darkness or the descent into darkness. But with Kazuo, he characterized an almost opposite trajectory. He sort of embodied a kind of whiteness, very ghostly and otherworldly. I think in my early 20s I was feeling quite shadowy and I was feeling quite hopeless, and he was an artist, an elder, who seemed to embody a kind of hope, a kind of really profound sense of hope. So I decided he was like my art parent, someone in whose footsteps I would follow, I would trust him.
Do
He's an amazing power of example as an artist who made his most crucial work, his masterwork, between the ages of 70 and 95. You know, people are sort of gearing up to give up in the West by 55. And I like what it implies, that it's not about prowess or elasticity. It's really about essence. And he really distilled it to a point where it was just pure essence. It was just a man. You could look at it from one point and just think, I've just sat for 2 hours watching a man stumbling around in a room. He's always reached, for instance, toward a feminine archetype. In his work, he was circling a dream of this one dancer that he saw when he was a kid, an Argentina flamenco dancer, or circling an idea about his mother, like the feminine nurturing circle that his mother cast around him as a child. And provided him with some relief. He always dressed in Victorian women's clothes when he danced. And I don't think anyone, I don't know the extent to which they had a dialogue about that within his culture. I mean, for me, obviously, for very different reasons, that's very interesting. You know, because a lot of my work is about moving towards the feminine, towards wholeness. Most profoundly, he affected my approach to live performance. And my way of dreaming as a live performer on stage.
Ooh, and I've been touched, and I've been touched. And it's too much, and it's too much.
Some of my songs, obviously my early songs especially, were written from a very personal point of view, and yet by the time I really started performing for thousands of people, I was relying on this whole other vocabulary to move me through the process of performing.
I'm in the ocean, in the sea.
Sort of radical lucid dreaming, like imagining that my voice was being carried by flight of birds or a body of wind.
You need only say the word, and I kiss you like a hummingbird.
Or that I could connect with the audience through lines of energy or lines of light. Anything promises the possibility of something expansive within it.
No.
I went out to Tokyo in March, and while Kazuo was still alive. Kazuo at that point, for the last 5 or 6 years, he's been basically laid up in bed, you know, becoming slowly and slowly more immobilized. And it was in that environment that I finally went out to Yokohama and visited him and his family, and we were received really warmly, and I dedicated the last album I'd made to him and put him on the cover of it, so they were aware of me and had been very generous in allowing me to use his image, and they ended up deciding that they really liked my music, and in fact they were playing my music to him in his bed practically 24 hours a day. They had it piped into him, and I said, God, turn it off, the poor thing. And they're like, no, he loves it. I'm like, how do you know he loves it?
Oh, thank you for your love.
I think that his dance really was his life and was probably, in his own mind, his clearest expression of his spirit. I mean, I'd already been sleeping under his image for 10 years before I even knew who he was, so couldn't do any harm to say that this was my mentor in a way. This was my... I wanted to dream in his footsteps.
Anthony Hegarty of Anthony and the Johnsons. Their new album is called Swan Lights, and you can see a video of Kazuo Ono's set to Anthony's music at studio360.org. Studio 360's Lita Molad produced our story. Is there some dancer or musician or artist who's changed your life? We want to hear about it at studio360.org.
When I was lost in the dark.
And that is it for this week's show. Don't forget that you can podcast any episode of the show anytime, anywhere, for free, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook as well. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Michael Guerriero,
Dory Carr-Harris,
Sarah D'Elia,
Mary Du.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at Scion.com. Studio 360 series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at Sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, a little bit classical, a little bit rock and roll, and just a pinch of cabaret. Mix it all together, and you've got My Brightest Diamond. The young singer and composer Shara Warden will perform live. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.